and good morning. This is Raise the Vibe on Voice of Vashon's 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Liz Peterson of Liz's Healing Touch here on Vashon Island. This morning in the studio with me, I have Ara Lee James, musician, singer, and songwriter. Hi, Ara. Welcome to the show. How are you doing this morning?
Hi, Liz.
I'm doing really well.
Yeah,
glad
it's so
you
good
could
to be
join
here.
Me this morning.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about yourself to get us started here this morning, Ara.
Well, Liz, what would you like to know?
So where are you from? How about we start there?
All the things?
Yes. You're new to Vashon. So let's learn who you are and where you're from.
Yeah. I moved to Vashon about 3 years ago. I moved from Portland, Oregon. And before Portland, I was in Denver. And then before that, I was in New York, Manhattan for 13 years. And then before that, all the way back, I grew up in Appalachia. So
Appalachia. What part of Appalachia?
In East Tennessee, I grew up in a little town called Sweetwater, Tennessee, in the Smoky Mountains.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah,
I've always wanted to visit
deep,
there.
Deep south.
So what was that like, you know, growing up in that area of the country?
The South is, especially that part of the South, really feels like its own country. It's interesting to travel across this country and think about how we're all united as a political entity. However, each part of the country has such a different flavor and feel. That part of the South and many parts of the South are also unique. And that part of the country where I grew up is particularly slanted toward ideology that is, you know, very, very deep and old.
Mm-hmm.
In my family, I grew up in a really religious family. So religion was what I learned from a very young age, right. And a very specific one, right? Sort of in the part where I grew up, where you went to church was your tribe. You know, who are you and where do you go to church were the two first questions. There wasn't really anything else beyond that identity. So my identity was with the particular sliver of religion that my family belonged to.
Okay, what was that, if you don't mind me asking?
It was called the Church of Christ.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then did you sing?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the thing about the Church of Christ, and that is still true today, is that instruments were and are not allowed in the church. So, and I certainly can't speak to how things perhaps may have changed. I haven't ascribed to that way of faith for a very long time. But as a kid, in our little denominational church, we instruments weren't even allowed in the building. So it happened that way because someone interpreted what they call the scripture to read that music was meant to be made in your hearts, right, and not with an instrument. And so they believed the only way to do that was with the voice. It was a very specific ideology.
So how did that bring that in?
So what'd you say?
How did they bring that in?
Yeah. So the way that we made music in that particular church was that we sang with our voices. And we had this hymnal that my mom still has one of these, and I'm sure they still exist, but they're this old blue hymnal, and it was really specific to the Church of Christ. And it was called Songs of the Church. You have to say that with a Southern accent. You can't really say Songs of the Church. It's Songs of the Church. And I, you know, these were songs, and they had, for each of the notes that you read, there was a different shape. So we call it now, looking back, shape note singing, which is where you can see the note move. So when your eye is reading, when there's not an instrument to help you hear, you can see the note change by what shape it changes, and it helps you sight read. So you'd have to see it to understand it,
right?
Maybe a little bit more, but
I'm getting a visual on it.
Yeah. So, you know, so I grew up sight reading melodies and lines and singing in SATB, which is soprano, alto, tenor, bass, that 4-part harmony.
Right.
And so everything I learned about music happened with my ears and happened through the voice. And our family went to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, as you do in that one.
Okay.
And then we had singing groups throughout the week, and we would sit and learn all the songs in the book so that when we got together, everyone could sing those songs. Wow. And we had singing groups on Sunday afternoon. And I still remember, you know, where different people sat in the church because you had your seat, you know, that you sat in. You didn't sit in Marilyn and Rob's, you know, you didn't sit in their seat. It was a big, you know, and so I could still hear where the voices came from in different seats because we all sort of had our parts that we had learned. And so my understanding of music came through sight reading and understanding music through listening. And I didn't know anything about music theory. It was all understanding chord structure through how it happened in my brain, really from the time I was born. And now I guess I've heard that there's a revival in Portland. I was walking down the street in Portland, in North Portland, and I heard a song come out with all of these people singing in harmony, and it was a song from my childhood. And I was like, wow. What the F is that? It was a shape note singing group where these people have, I guess, started shape note singing, and they've taken these old hymns, these old songs, and they sit and sing. And these aren't religious people. These are people just doing it for the love of singing and community. And I thought that was fascinating that people still do that.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
I mean, certainly people still do it all over the country in their way of worship, but that singing without instruments is something that is really special, regardless of what you believe. So that was sort of my background. I'm growing up in Tennessee. And then I played the fiddle. I grew up playing Suzuki violin. I played classical violin as a child. I started when I was 4. And then I played fiddle, but that only happened, you know, on the porch. That didn't happen in the church. So music for me was segregated between sort of performance and then music done in the context of community and worship and sort of creating and connecting to something that was sacred.
Oh, can you tell us a little bit more about that? That sounds like a good foundation for me musically.
Yeah. So, and you and I have talked a little bit about this. For me, you know, it's interesting. Many musicians that I know come at music from sort of, you know, you cut your teeth in music and it's hard to unbraid what was braided into you as a child. You know, I was just with a friend named Sarah Siskind, who's an incredible singer-songwriter, and she's a songwriter for the show Nashville, and she, you know, she's just a wonderful human being, and everything that she does is really rooted in what she learned as a child, which was her dad teaching her Celtic guitar, and she plays a lot in Dadgad because that's what she learned, and her songwriting comes from those places, you know. Right. And for me, songwriting and music, or I should just say music before we get into songwriting, is it was a place for me where I connected to something that was outside of theology, outside of dogma, outside of dogma, I guess is the best word to say. Like, this is how
for people
to,
who don't know what dogma is.
Oh, thank you.
Is.
Yeah. Yeah. So dogma, I guess, would be, you could describe it as the way, the lens through which you view the divine. So like, let's take something like a book that a bunch of men put together and decided these were sacred scriptures. And a lot of people call that the Bible. Some people just say it's a book men put together. Some people say it's the holy word of God. But depending on how you're raised or what you believe, you know, your dogma is... What is my version of faith? What is my version of how I view the divine? And for me, I had a lot of problems with the dogma, the assigned way to practice that faith, and the structure that as it had been interpreted in that particular religion.
Right.
And I had a lot of blocks with that for how I view what one might call God. And so for me, music was a place where none of that mattered. And music reached through and connected me in a way that was wordless and without faith identity and without this is the window through which you must look to find truth. And for me, that is still how I see music, and it's still the place where, for me, music exists in its truest form. This isn't like a blanket statement, like this is how music should be. Music feeds so many different people in different ways, but for me, that is something that I can't unbraid, that I think that music reaches through. Music, to me, feels like my religion, my spiritual practice, my way that I connect to something that is sacred or holy or something that is truly wordless.
That's beautiful. And you really do have a passion for music and bring it through in a really beautiful way, empowering way. Mm-hmm. We've talked about community and music before. Can you tell us a little bit about how you feel about how music brings community?
Yeah, well, I can talk about sort of leaving music as community and then finding my way back to it.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
And why that feels like that matters. So when I left the South, I moved to New York City when I was 17. And I had some, so that was an interesting journey, those 13 years living in Manhattan.
Wow.
And that was
a
when.
Big difference. Big,
yeah. Singing songs with people who could barely keep a tune, you know, helping each other out to going to regular performances at the Met. You know, I mean, these are two extremes of how music is used in the world. My dad lived in Manhattan with his husband, and He and Jeff would take me to regularly to the Met. He was a sponsor, so we got to go to the very fancy booths and go, you know, hobnob with very, you know,
great experience.
Very, you know, the echelon of New York. I don't know. You know, you had to really lose that Southern accent, is what I'm saying. Yeah. And so we would go. We had weekly tickets to the Met, and he took me to opening nights of all the Broadway shows. And
what a gift.
Yeah, it was. That was an. I mean, I look back now, and I yawned my way through Carmen. You know, and I was just like, "Oh, Dad, can we go?" But that was my experience. And so I visited my dad always in New York in the summer growing up in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 17, I moved there full time.
Okay.
And so my exposure to music then took a different turn, and it was all about performance, right? And it was about training. And I started training with a vocal coach there. His name was Dean Johnson. And that became the process of me learning how to cultivate my voice and train my voice to do things I didn't know it could do. Okay. And to train it for performance, which is very different than singing community. And,
definitely.
And so I learned a lot about that, and I did a lot of studio singing in New York, where I sang on records and albums and for radio and commercial, and did that sort of thing when it existed.
That's
different
fun.
Than different than it is today. Mm-hmm. But when people hired vocalists to come in and sing for a jingle, you know, when jingles were a thing and they weren't something that they just sort of took from. So, and that was all performance, and it was learning how to work in a studio and how to work a stage and how to work in a large group versus a small group and how to sing in a jazz club versus Carnegie Hall. So
nice. Yeah. So where did that lead you in your musical career?
That led me, it's hard to separate where that led me musically and just New York City, which was a cold, dead raisin heart.
Mm. No. Yeah, tell us about that.
Not really. Almost the flame. Yeah, I think New York is an intense place to live. And certainly my life choices had taken me to a place when I was about 30 where there wasn't a lot of spark of life force left. Mm. And that again, these were life lessons that I had to learn that happened to be in New York. And whether or not that has to do with the music industry or New York, I mean, the music industry is great. It is what it is. But to have gone through what I went through. And so for a while, after that sort of performance time in life, I stopped singing. I stopped singing completely. At the end of my 20s, and I didn't sing really at all for quite a few years.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
Well, that might be a different show, but okay. I had left a tough situation. Let's put it at that. And so I needed some time, and I traveled, and nice. I left New York, and I left everything that I knew at that time. And I just got quiet, you know, as you do, I think when you're healing and
A rebirth.
It was a rebirth. It was. That's when I started going by the name Ara.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So my legal name is Carla. People don't know that except my family.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I know. My mom and sister still call me Carla, but they're the ones that still. But I started going by Ara around that time.
So how'd you come upon Ara?
Well, because we're on a hippie, a woo-woo show, I can tell you the real story, which I don't often tell. Okay. So I had gone by Carla, and I was having a meditation. My gosh, I have never told this story out in public. So here you go. Here it is. All the woo-woo. I was getting five elements acupuncture by this really wonderful acupuncturist in Denver.
Okay.
Named Lisa. And I was meditating on the table. This is the first time in my life I had ever met and just understood meditation. Remember, I had been raised in a very religious faith. And the other part of that story is that I had become a minister in a Christian faith in New York. And so I preached all over the world under the umbrella of Christianity.
Okay.
So when that was something that I thoroughly had left behind, this was the quiet time where I sat and I started listening and started seeing the world through stillness and through poetry and through great writers that I had never read, Rumi and all the Sufi poets and really just poetry. And my spiritual awakening really was ushered in by poets and Mary Oliver and these incredible poets who and Rainer Maria Rilke and people who helped me to see the world through a lens that wasn't the Bible, because that's all I had ever known. And and interestingly, I wasn't going to tell the story, but remind me what I was going to say. Oh, the name change. We'll get to that. But I was in New York. I had left my my idea of faith, which was huge because it is, it's what I had known since I was born. I had left a marriage that had been arranged for me in that faith, that I was in New York, and left my career, left my, arranged marriage, left, my view of the world and my community. And in sort of in one fell swoop when I realized that this was built on something that wasn't, for me, the truth. And I found a book. I went back to school and I found, I was walking down in the Lower East Side, New York, and in a coffee shop, there was a book called Prayers for a Thousand Years. And it was a compilation. I'm sure, I think Robert Bly had something to do with it, but it was a compilation of poets and spiritual teachers and just a book of poetry, sort of, I think, talking about the world in a spiritual way. And I had never read these things. I had never read words like this before. I was 29 years old.
Wow, one of those books that just falls off
the shelf. Yes, it fell into my hands. And in that book was Mary Oliver's poem, The Journey, and Wild Geese, and you know, these really famous poems. And then that is where, and Rumi, I read Rumi for the first time. These little, I'm like, who is this? And who is this? And who is this? And who is this? And I read my way through this book. And then I started buying books of these poets that I had found in this little book. And now someone asked me if I went to a desert island, what I would take, and it would be like my poetry collection, my guitar, and my journal.
Nice.
That would be it. That would be it. I would die in a week, but I would go really. So that's when I discovered a new way of seeing the world and what I would call my view, my brand of spirituality, which fundamentally involves sitting still and observing and being open to thinking differently about life. And I think that's always true, right? Like, I don't think that now I'm in a place where I'm like, I have the answer now. This is the answer. Because the one thing I learned is that that is what really limits you and gets you into trouble and
really
constipates
does.
Your soul, right?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Forever and growing beings.
Forever pushing past the comfort zone feels like the spiritual journey, right?
Right.
And so also in that time, I found, you know, Pema Chodron and Thich Nhat Hanh and these people
them.
That, again, like this, these are the spiritual awakening of just thinking differently, thinking openly, thinking without a specific dogma that says this is how one must think.
And with compassion and love and openness for all.
Yeah. And then compassion for myself, you know, to look back and think, God, I lost 29 years of my life preaching right and wrong and heaven and hell to people. And I had so much shame about that. And I didn't talk about it a lot because I felt so embarrassed. And, and then at that time when I left that place, I helped then, I had a wonderful therapist who helped people leave extreme religions and I helped people leave. And a lot of people who left this particular one, this wasn't the Church of Christ that I grew up in. This was a different one, but this one was so brainwashing. It was very cult-like. And, I helped people leave. There were people that committed suicide when they would leave this because it had been so intense. And so this understanding of leaving a world of black and white and entering this massive world of gray, to me is sort of the great awakening. And I feel that now about music, sort of leaving this idea of music and seeing it one way and into this world of gray where music can be all of these different things. Right. But I had found this book and I was meditating. So we get to the name change part. So I was meditating and I was on the table having a five elements acupuncture session.
Fabulous.
And I was in a really deep place. And at that time when I would meditate, I would get a vision. I don't know if vision is the word, but I would see this picture in my mind really clearly. Very clearly. And my mom has what she calls visions, but she attributes them as a gift of the Holy Spirit. That's her lens, right? Mm-hmm. And I've always seen things around people and I've always seen aura colors and I'll see like flashes of what's going on in someone's life I've always seen physical, I've always seen things, but that sounds super crazy. So I don't really talk about
it,
right?
At all.
Not on this show, I can say those things,
you
right?
Can definitely talk
and
about
so
it
people
here.
Are like, and I'll see things that are going to happen. You know, I'll meet someone who's pregnant and I'll know something is going on with that baby they're just a knowing, right?
Right.
So in this particular session, I was laying there and I saw this scene that I still see sometimes when I meditate, but it was very clear at that time in my life. And it was a pond, and on the left was a big forest of trees and on the right was nothing, like desert. Oh. And on the left, and I was sitting at this water looking at the water, and that's where I would sit. And so in this meditation, I saw a person coming out of the forest and was walking toward me. And I'm like, well, this is interesting. Who's this person? And this person was walking on the left side of the lake. And then I realized it was a woman. And so I watched her walk all the way around the lake, and I sat really still, and I watched her come toward me. And then I realized she looked like me. And as she came closer and closer, I realized she was me. And it was me without shame, me without, you know, pimples, me without my hair, me like as I would be if I had dropped all the bull S, I won't say on the radio, but like me without the layers, right? And it was, and I looked at her and I was like, you're so beautiful. Like it was like this beautiful entity, and it was my reflection. And she came toward me and sat down next to me. And I said, what is your name? And she said, Aura.
I have goosebumps.
And I sat there with her, and she sat down with me, and I thought, you are me without what I have decided to be. Like, you are me without what I should be. And so I decided after that meditation that I would call myself Aura. And I felt like Aura was like the distillation of Carla, like C-A-R-L-A. It was sort of like taking the essence of my name and taking that name. And so from that meditation, I told my friend Jenny, I was like, I told her about the meditation. I was like, I think my name, my actual name is Aura. And she was like, girl, she was woo-woo. She was like, let's call you Aura. And so I was like, I'll just make it a stage name. And then it ended up becoming my name, and I didn't. And then Carla felt like it was something that I dropped at that time.
That is a fantastic story.
So that's my woo-woo story of how I got my name. Now the dinner party story, if somebody says, how'd you get your name? I'll say, oh, it's a stage name, and then it stuck, because that is way easier to tell.
Right.
And that was in a deep meditation. But that's when I started going by Aura. And this year I'm going to legally change my name to Aura. Finally.
Oh, I'm so excited for you. That's amazing. Great. Okay, so we're having acupuncture. We're having visions. Okay, where does this lead you? Where does this lead you in your musical career?
So then at that time I was living in, I decided to move into an RV, sell everything I had, and barter my way across the country and convert it to run on vegetable oil.
Sweet.
That's what was going on. So, you know, I had my phase of letting go of everything. Later in life, I sort of did everything backwards. And when I was traveling around in that van, that was the first time in my life I had ever been to a music festival.
Really?
Because I had been raised in a church where there was only one approved sort of way of listening to music. Mm-hmm. And so that was not something that I was accessible to me. I had never lived in the Northwest. I didn't understand music in that way. And the first music festival I ever went to was String Summit, outside of Portland, Oregon.
Oh, I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah. And it was, you know, a bluegrass and sort of led festival. I mean, there's a lot of music there, but and it was a smaller one. But I camped for 3 days. I was living in this van. It was broken down. So I met this random guy at a, you know, in Seattle on the street, and he was like, let's go to String Summit. I was like, woohoo. It's just that phase, right?
Yeah, so nice.
So I went there and
following the threads.
That's right. Following the wind. I was riding the wind at that time. And I went to that festival and I was like, what is this? And then people sat around and played music. And of course, this is not revolutionary for most people. Like sitting around in a circle while people are playing music feels like up here, I guess people do it all the time. This was mind blowing to me that people could sit around and do this. And so music started getting woken up. This was right at the very beginning of my 30s.
Awesome.
And I was getting woke maybe to music in that way, right? And so then I started going to a lot of music in Portland. I ended up landing in Portland. And I, found out at that time that I was pregnant.
Congratulations.
With my now 9-year-old. Nice. And so I thought I need to land because I'm living in a van and I should probably, you know, I had just kind of landed in Portland and all this happened. And, ended up, so that was Willa. And then, I had Willa and thought, what now? You know, what's next? And in the religious organization that I had been involved in, I wasn't allowed to go to college. I only went to seminary. I was only allowed to study what was approved. And so I had never gotten a college degree and thought, I need to go back and get my college degree. So
awesome.
I went back. I got a full scholarship, miraculously, based on an essay that I wrote about having been in a cult and having left and waking up and now being a mother and trying to figure out what was next. And I got one of the few full scholarships at PSU, which was an absolute miracle.
That's fantastic.
And was able to go back to school and decided to study music. And for me, that was the scariest thing I had ever, I honestly, like studying music felt like I don't know what I'm doing. I didn't know anything other than where middle C was on a piano. I had played Suzuki violin, which was also all by ear. So yeah. I knew nothing about music theory. I knew how to sing and I knew an understanding of structure in my mind and how chords worked, but I didn't understand it on paper.
So
and I was
really jumping
so
into
scared.
An unknown.
Yeah. And also the unknown of like a degree in music is like a degree in crackers and unicorn, you know, unicorns and rainbows. It doesn't exactly translate right at this age, but uh-huh. I was like, this is what I love. I'm going to do it. I'm going to try. So I got a job teaching music to kids and part-time and went to music school full-time with a 9-month-old.
So gosh, that's fantastic. So what was music school like for you?
Music school was harrowing. I remember I went to music theory 101 and they said, you need to take this little test before you can pass music theory 101 or, mm-hmm. and just to make sure you can get in.
Right.
And I failed the music theory 101 test. And they were like, you need to go to remedial music
wow.
theory class.
So everybody's got to start.
Right.
Anywhere.
And I was like, I had some ego. Like I've been a professional singer, you know, like I know what I'm doing.
Right?
I can teach y'all how to perform, but I did not know what a triad was. I'm like, what's a triad? Is that some sort of Olympic move? You know,
I wouldn't have known either.
Right. What's a triad? I don't know. Isn't that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? The Trinity? Is that the same
right?
thing? I don't know. So I had to go back to this class called Basic Materials.
Nice.
This wonderful teacher,
foundations.
John. And I had to learn basic things like what's a major chord and a minor chord and what's a circle of fifths and how does it all work together? And here's a keyboard and this is the... And so, you know, I learned really like basic music theory. And it helped me, of course, understand music in a different way.
Uh-huh.
Music theory is still not my strength. I struggled for 3 years to pass the test. And it is, again, felt miraculous that I did it. But I was in these classes with these 17-year-olds who were like, you know, transposing figured bass on their computers. And I'm like, I'm still trying to figure out the circle of fifths, y'all. This is really complicated for my brain. And but I made it through. And I'm in that time sang in the Portland State Chamber Choir, and I got to sing with this extraordinary group of people. And
really, how'd you find that?
I had to take it for a class in order to graduate with a music degree. You had to have a performance quotient, and someone said you have to do this. So you're either going to do this or do this. I was the first jazz vocalist actually in that program. They had a jazz program, but no vocals.
Interesting.
Vocal students. So I had to take that for a class, and then ended up getting in this really incredible group led by Dr. Ethan Sperry, and that was an incredible experience. But when I went into audition for that program, there was no vocal jazz program, and I knew I didn't want to do opera. All the years of falling asleep in Carmen told
right.
me this is not my jam.
That's not my path.
It's beautiful art form, not what lights me up.
Right.
And so I went to sing for the director of the jazz program, who I had heard play in town, and I was so blown away by his spirit. So I said, Daryl, I know you run the jazz program. Will you hear me sing? I know there's not a vocal program. So I went in and sang for him. And that was the first time in many, many years that I had opened my mouth and sang and sung out loud. And he played a song and we sang together. And he said, girl, let's do this. We'll start the program with you. And I started working with Valerie Day, who's a Grammy nominated wonderful singer. And she became my mentor and started taking vocal lessons with her and learning how to sing jazz, how to perform, how to understanding what a lead sheet was, what a chart was, how to lead a band, all the things they have to do in the jazz world, and started, that was, again, super uncomfortable outside of my comfort zone, going to jazz gigs and having to, getting my little lead sheets together with my pencil, you know, like I couldn't figure out finale. And so I would write out all my chords and take them to a jazz gig and sit with these players that were so intimidating and have to, you know, call out chords and tell them how to count in and counting different rhythms and just, you know, learning these ways of leading and performing. And but that day that I sang for Daryl was the first time I had sung. And when I got in my car after, I just lost it. I wept and wept and wept and wept because I was so relieved to be singing again after so many years.
Right.
And I was 32 at that time.
Wow, 32.
Yeah.
And where did that lead you?
So then music school, and that's when I started writing songs. I had to write my first song for an assignment. Gypsy Woman
tell
was
us
a,
about
yes,
that.
A Gypsy Woman was a song that I wrote for an assignment, a music theory, a music production class. They you had to write a song and record it in GarageBand and turn it in, and I was like, oh man, this
so
is
so your first
a
experience
disaster.
At writing a song was an assignment
was an assignment for
school.
For was an assignment for a class.
Okay.
Yep. And so I sat down with my ukulele. I played violin, and that wasn't really conducive for writing and singing. And I was teaching kids, so I taught myself ukulele so I could teach kids. Cool. And started playing in class, and then started playing tenor guitar, and then eventually guitar. But that was all in the context of just having to do that because I wanted to teach music to kids. And so this song was on a ukulele. I knew maybe two or three chords at that point, and I wrote the song with three chords, you know, three of the six chords that I knew. And I still love playing that song. And then my friend Catherine Claire, who's going to be playing with me at the VCA.
Oh, great.
And next Friday, she's a violinist, and she was hearing some of the stuff I was writing. We met backstage at a show where she was opening for a friend of mine, Stephanie Schneiderman. I was singing backup for Stephanie, and we met backstage, and she was like, girl, we just, you know, we connected. And she wrote a violin part to that song, and it blew my mind that someone could write something so beautiful around three chords. And so we started singing that song together, and then I just kept writing and got the bug and thought, man, I can write simple songs with three chords. I can do this. You know, yeah. I'm not writing concertos, but this is really fun. And I just did it because I loved it. And then once you start doing it, it is, you know, and you realize it's just a fun thing to do. For me, I just started writing all the time. And then songwriting became a part of just, you know, dailiness.
And how has that fed your soul?
In indescribable ways.
I can't sit down and write a song.
I don't believe you. I would make you do it right now, but I'm not going to make you do it live.
Okay, great.
Yes, you can. I believe you can.
All right. We'll have to explore that when we're not recording, for sure.
Oh, my gosh. I'm really tempted to make you do it. Do you know that's one of the things that we do with adults who think they can't songwrite is, do you know that song, You Are My Sunshine?
Oh, yes. You sing that to my kids all the time.
So you can take that melody and write something new. Like if you were going to write something about your coffee. You could say, what could you say about your coffee?
My yogi herbal tea.
Right. What could you say?
My great quote on the side of the little ticket.
Right.
Here.
So what does that quote say?
Say it straight, simple, with a smile.
Right. So say it straight and say it simple and maybe say it with a smile.
Oh, I love that.
I read my coffee this morning. And now I'll smile for miles, you know, whatever.
Nice.
Like you can take
simple.
That's simple, right? Like that's what happens, Liz. You just wrote a song.
Wow.
Right.
Nice. Thank you, Aura.
You did
it.
That was your first song.
You are all witnessing
that's
my
it,
first song.
Right? So one of the things you can do is take a melody that you know and take words that are sitting around and write a song, get an idea. I love my coffee. I love my coffee. I drink it with half and half. You can take words and then you take those words, throw out that melody and try a new melody with words you've just written.
Ah.
Right. So there are but that's like the simplest exercise to sort of go down the road of songwriting. Every single person can do it. A 3-year-old can do it. An adult can do it. So you can see my passion for songwriting has become teaching now adults, which is where I am today. But
before we start in the adult portion, let's go back to the kids, because I think, you know, that being your start, let's really explore, like, you taught kids in Portland. How was that?
Yeah, I taught kids in Portland with this wonderful program called Music Together. And it's a early music education program. You know, it's similar to Kinder Music. I don't know as much about Kinder Music, but Music Together, I studied with the woman who founded Music Together, and she talked so much about early musical development and how musical development is just like speaking. Like there's a window as a child that you learn how to speak, and it's a lot harder to learn a language later in life than it is during this window.
Yes.
And it's the very same with musical development. So musical development happens in that window the same way speaking does. And if we're not singing in our homes and singing melodies and singing lullabies and playing with our kids and having music accessible, not in a passive listening situation, but in playing together with music, then you can miss that window. And it makes it a lot harder later in life to learn how to carry a tune, how to have rhythm, because we've sort of lost that part of making music together in our families. And so this program helps you. It's not kids in a class with a teacher, it's kids and parents. And all of us get silly and make music and play together. And then you take the songs home and you play with the songs at home. And so the parents have to be silly too. The parents have to sing no matter how good or bad they quote think they sing. And then it lets the kids see, oh, we all do this. This isn't just something that I go do. And
we can do
this together. I called Music Together, right?
Nice.
And so I did that for years in Portland as I went through school.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you shared a quote with me last night about play.
Yeah. And, oh, I'd love to share that. Yes.
Share that with us.
So I put it in my phone so I wouldn't misquote. Misquote it says, this is Karen Purvis. She says, it takes approximately 400 repetitions to create a new synapse in the brain. So that's daunting because you're like, I need to play a chord 400 times before I remember how my shapes are going to go. Or, right?
Okay. Right, yeah.
Unless it is done with play, in which case it takes between 10 and 20 repetitions.
Wow, that is so drastic. So
isn't
amazing.
That amazing? Right. So
through play.
Play. Play is the key to creativity and really just the key to life. I am learning.
I'm learning that too. I am learning. Do we find our joy in life?
Not everything is so dead dog serious, y'all. And if you can just play, it really does open up your heart and spirit. But teaching kids teach you that. Having kids teaches you that. If you can stop being so serious and washing dishes and yelling at them to put away the laundry, like there's, which I do those things too, but they teach you that. And they teach you how to make music. They teach you how to sing and play and be silly. Jeannie writes songs all day long.
Really?
Oh, all day long. Just about whatever, you know.
That's awesome.
She gets a melody and she'll write something.
And playing and
because no one has told her yet she's not a good singer or that she's not allowed or that she's not going to be a professional and so she should stop. So she hasn't heard that yet. So she doesn't know that she's not a singer, you know.
And so often, you know, in school, we're told, you know, you don't sing. I've been told by people or laughed at by people, you can't sing.
Which is funny because I've heard you sing and you can sing. You have a lovely voice.
You shared that with me. You know, working with you has been a blessing in my life.
Yeah.
For sure. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So
share your viewpoints on that.
Yeah. I'll see how much time we have. So,
Plenty
of time. Okay. Yeah. So I did the performance thing. I got my degree, which, you know, was amazing, and I was performing and started singing. I made this record and it was an EP, but then a couple songs got licensed and some really amazing things happened from that very small effort. And so then I started gigging and performing pretty regularly as a performer.
Okay.
And I enjoyed it. And I did a few gigs that, you know, at the time were things I thought, gosh, this is huge, right? I'm playing at this place with these people. Mm-hmm. You know, this is sort of like the goal, right? For me, I felt, you know, like, wow, I get to sing with these people who are really famous, really good, really all these things. And I just felt like, God, is this it? Is this it? This does not feel
really,
like
you were
the
feeling
point.
That
oh,
while
yes.
Performing with all of these famous people.
Yes. So I did a show and I won't name names, but I performed with a number of people and got a lot of positive feedback. I got some really good reviews from some national publications, and I sang at this place that was like, for me, a really big deal.
Awesome.
And I went home that night and I felt so done.
Really?
And I was like, this doesn't feel right.
So it sounds the total opposite of what I would imagine. Like, I would feel like I made it.
Right. And I did not feel that way.
Wow.
And I think part of why I felt that way was it felt like this is about ego. Like, it felt like so empty. Right. And I loved the music that I was doing, but it felt like the whole scene, it was like a lot of people drinking and it was so much about fame and it felt so empty. Now,
your soul was wanting more.
And just for me, and this isn't to say that there's anything wrong with that world or there's anything wrong with being famous. For goodness sake, any way you can find a way to make a living and make music, do it. Go all the way. Right. You know,
it's so rare.
Right. And for me, I felt like this doesn't feel, I don't know if there's sort of a calling. Right. And so, not long after that, I moved to Vashon and, I've been here now for 3 years. And in the course of that move, a lot of shifts happened in my life as well as that, you know, very well. And in the context of that, I started writing with a woman named Beth Wood, who was one of my very favorite singer songwriters and her music. We were both booked to play at a gig. We each had a 30-minute set and I heard her sing and I ugly cried. In the front row, I was so blown away. And I thought, this is the most amazing singer-songwriter I've ever heard. And because she sang from a place that it changed the molecular structure of the room. You know, like people felt something. They felt something. She wasn't up there proving anything. Like I was changed. And when I sang, that's what I feel like I do. And it doesn't always fit in bars or in a place where people want to know who you are or who you're connected to, right? Like, and so... and I felt like she vibrated in a similar way. And then not long after that, we became friends that night, and we're like, oh God, we need to do something. And then we were both chosen to be artists in residence at a writing retreat. And she and I went on this week-long retreat, which was, I'd never done this since I had kids. I got to sit for a week and stare and write songs, which was crazy. And awesome. That week was the week that I wrote with Beth, Nasty Woman, the song that became that
which
single.
Which is fantastic.
And we wrote together and realized we just really loved writing together and being together. And, mm-hmm. you know, to create a musical partnership with someone, you're like, you got to want to spend time in the car, you know, and laugh yes. and write. And so we started writing more and more and more and did a few shows that were co-bills. So we would each do a set. And then we're like, dude, we need to make a record and just do this thing because this is so much fun. And every time I would perform with Beth, I felt like my soul was jumping around in a field doing cartwheels. And it felt so easy. And singing harmony with her felt so easy. And writing with her felt so easy. And I think it sort of awakened this part of me where I wasn't sort of pushing a rock up some sort of ego hill that never inspired me.
Right.
And so for the two of us, this past year has been making that record and touring it. And in conjunction with that, we have so much, so we talk a lot about this feeling of like music for her as well, is a place of spirit. She's been touring full time on the road for over 20 years. She's made 12 records now.
Wow.
She's won every songwriting contest in the country. She judges all the songwriting contests in the country now. She is, you know, in the folk world, she's kind of like a legend in the folk world. And she doesn't write music. You know, people always ask her why she doesn't go to Nashville. And she's like, cause I'm unwilling to sort of, to get into the cog, you know, Nashville's its own thing, right?
Yeah.
And her music sort of lives outside of that. It breaks you open in a different way, and she's always felt protective of it. And she's made her living and her life making her own songs, doing it her own way. And so in this project, I get to work with somebody who is a real hero for me.
Yeah.
And then we get to sing together, and I feel like my feet lift off the floor a couple inches every time our voices lock in. And we made this record that felt like it was the like easiest thing I've ever done. And we're releasing that record in October.
Oh, fantastic. And what's that called so people can keep their eyes out?
Yeah. So our duo is called Stand and Sway. Beth is also a poet and she writes poetry and we send each other poems. And her poetry book was just won the Oregon Book of the Year Award, Reader's Choice Award, which was amazing.
Fabulous. Yeah, that is amazing.
And on the record, we do one of her poems, which is called A Woman Will Stand and Sway. And I always wanted to put a soundscape around poetry and her poems so people will listen to
right.
them. And so that is a sound. It's a song with the soundscape around it. And then she reads her poem with all of these sounds.
Nice.
And so we do that. We do that live and we do it on the record. And so that's where our duo name comes from, Stand and Sway. And
cool.
Our compass with why we do this work is we do it because we want to raise the vibration. So we were talking one day
nice.
And we're like, Beth, what do we want to do with this music? I don't want to be like, this isn't about being in Rolling Stone. Like, I'd rather mm-hmm. be on Being. I'd rather be.
Yeah.
And so
bring the light.
Yeah. Like, and I was like, Beth, what do you want to do? What do we want to do? Like, what's the point of what we're doing? And she said, Ara, I want to raise the vibration of this world, and I want to make a lot of money doing it somehow. I don't know how that second part's going to
yes.
happen, right? And so, but raise the vibration, like that was number one. So that night we did a show, and at intermission of the show, I walked out and there was a man, he had big tears in his eyes, and he grabbed my arms and he said, I just want to tell you that you two have raised the vibration.
Yes.
And that's all he said. And then he like walked away, and I was like, Beth. And just before that show, we'd had that conversation in the bathroom getting ready, you know.
And that's such a different experience
yes.
than what you were feeling
and
before.
And that is the difference between being at a bar with all these national publications that were reviewing stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this doesn't matter.
Yeah,
like,
it's meaningless.
I'm not making music for people to get wasted to and check out, right?
Yeah.
With the music that we make is music that you listen to and it affects you. So we've decided we really only play to listening rooms now. And what that means is that it's going to not, you know, our trajectory might look a little different, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to take any gig. Now, we are, having said that, we're playing at a bar in Portland only because our friends, Rob and Naomi, are playing there and they asked us to do a residency with them.
Oh, that's
their
great.
Moody Little Sister. They're going to be at the VCA in a few months. So if you're
oh,
seeing
great.
This, please go see the Moody Little Sister, Rob and Naomi Stroop. He's who produced my first record, and Naomi is a dear friend and sister. And so they asked us to do a set. So occasionally we'll do things like that, but
right.
we really don't do bar gigs or gigs like that anymore. It's just not the work that I think this music needs to do. And that is the opposite of ego. It's not about you must listen. It's like, this is what this music is here for. Right. And so
and
we
try to
protect
it. And you guys do workshops together, right?
Yeah. So In addition to music, we have decided to create this sort of own entity. We call it Open Song. And we teach singing, songwriting, poetry writing, in general, creativity, unlocking, and play for adults who think that they are not creative and not singers and not songwriters and not poets.
I'm signing up.
I know. And so we just did one before a festival in Brevard. We sang at the festival. And then before, she and Sarah Siskind and I taught this workshop and it for songwriters. And it was a few days. We're doing a workshop this weekend on Orcas Island. And to sit in a room with adults who this is why, it's like the experience of somebody like writing about you in a publication and getting a little hit and posting it on Facebook and people mm-hmm. thinking you're cool. There's one.
Yeah.
Sitting in a room with a woman who's 72 and who's never written a song before and who stands up and sings her very first song. I'm emotional just thinking about this yeah. woman and watching her access music because she's just trying. And we sat down after this record, this group. This was in North Carolina. And she said, I thought that life was over. I was sort of out of dreams. And I have a new dream now that I can write music and I can make songs. Beautiful. And she has this dream to sing in her community center and to sing for old folks homes and to sing for, you know, old folks homes is probably the wrong politically correct way to say it. Senior centers. And you know what I'm saying?
Okay, yes.
Sorry, I'm from the South. I say stuff like that. I mean, I still said Indian style the other day, and I'm like, girl, it's not Indian style. It's, you know, crisscross applesauce.
Yes,
that's right. Hello.
Over here.
Y'all, this is the racism implanted in our words. Anyway, so, you know, but her experience of singing in front of this group, take that and compare it with ego and fame, and it is no contest.
No contest.
Like, this is why, you know, this is what music is for, and music is for every human being. It is not for singers. It is not just for the ego. It is certainly not just for the radio and for people who make a record or don't. Can I tell you that statistic about the radio? This is my favorite thing. I wish I had the exact numbers and I don't, but in the 1930s, 20s and 30s, if you took a survey of America, I learned this in my training with Music Together, and you asked and you surveyed how many people can carry a tune, that number would be like 85%, like in the 80s or 90s.
Right.
And today, if you take a survey, how many people can carry a tune? It's less than 20%.
Wow.
Now, think about asking people how many people can carry a tune in your room of 10 people, or how many people are singers. Maybe two would raise their hand in a room of 10. And what happened when it sort of went like that was when radio was invented, when radio came into people's homes and people started passively listening to music in the background and listening to music as something that belonged to performers. Mm-hmm. As something that belonged to singers or musicians, right? Musicians with a capital N.
Not accessible. Yeah.
And stopped singing in groups loudly and off key and badly and for joy and fun. And they stopped doing this group singing, group home, you know, music as a cornerstone of community. And it became something that other people did.
Mm.
And it became, for me, Western culture took it and mass marketed it and put money on it and made it something else that was consumed. Music became consumed just like our resources have been consumed. So I wanted to read this.
Please.
If you're watching, if the 25 of you are watching this, The Music of Life, this is an extraordinary book by Hazrat Inayat Khan, and he was a contemporary of Rumi, and he was a musician, and he writes about music, and I want to read, this is my new sort of Bible. It says, music has a mission not only with the multitudes, but with individuals, and its mission with the individual is as necessary and great as its mission with the multitude. All the trouble in the world and all the disastrous results arising out of it all come from lack of harmony. The world needs harmony today more than ever before. When a person learns music, he need not necessarily learn to be a musician or to become a source of pleasure and joy to his fellow man. No, but by playing, loving, and hearing music, he must develop music in his personality. The true use of music is to become musical in one's thoughts, words, and actions. We must be able to give the harmony for which the soul yearns and longs every moment. All the tragedy in the world, in the individual, comes from lack of harmony, and harmony is best given by producing harmony in one's own life. There will come a day when music will become the religion of humanity.
I love that.
Isn't that beautiful?
It is very beautiful.
Yeah. Thank music belongs to all of us, right?
Music belongs. So how do we gain that back in community?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it begins with trying, playing. I know Kat forever hosted that Celtic, that circle at Snapdragon, yes, like where people sat around.
Uh-huh.
One thing, and I'd love to know if anybody's listening to this, or for the people that are, if they have ideas for how we can do it more on Vashon. I would love to teach some open song workshops on Vashon, but more than that, it's how do we create an environment that is a non-religious, non-performance environment for people to sit and make music together? One way, I think, is hearing live music, not listening to it passively, but hearing music, because live music does take you places that the radio and your phone and a speaker does not. The frequencies that we hear in a room when someone's singing are completely different than something you hear on a radio. It affects our soul and our ear totally differently. That's studied, right?
Wow.
So we take in frequency differently. Mm-hmm. And music, the frequency of music in a live environment literally changes the vibration of your body and does not when heard through a radio, right?
Right.
So, I mean, you can hear the music and be changed, certainly, but it's a different frequency how it affects your body, right? And so hearing live music is one, and then finding ways to participate in making music together. I have a really hard time with open mics. They actually scare me to death, and I'm a professional musician. I don't like them. It's like, here's my open mic. I'm just going to go do my one song, and it's really nerve-wracking. I'm still scared of them. And like song circles where people sit around and jam, that's my least favorite thing maybe in the whole world. Because sometimes, I have found, probably not the one Kat leads, but a lot of song circles end up being very... who can play faster and louder? And they're kind of, they tend to be a little male, like, right? Like, I'm going to sit here with my instrument and prove what I can do in my circle. Certainly not all of them are that way, but there is a thing there. Mm-hmm. And I tend to enjoy the energy of the feminine, balancing that male energy where we sit in a very supportive environment and don't explain why we should do things differently to each other.
That sounds lovely.
Yeah. Unsolicited advice often happens in song circles when you play a
song.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Often by someone who, of the male persuasion, or someone with a lot of male energy, and they have a lot of things to say about your songs.
Speaking from experience.
I sure am. And so, you know, Beth leads those circles all over the world. Uh-huh. And she's like, yep, you know, we need a lot more feminine ladies sitting around in these circles and saying, good on ya. Well done.
Supportive.
What else do you have in there? Like, let's keep trying.
Nice.
Because that is how creativity
keeps
getting
born. And I think we need more of that in the community, period.
Yeah.
Yeah, more support, more empowering each other to be who we are.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Step in their being. So share some stories with us. I know you've got to have something with everything that's been going on.
Oh, my goodness. Well, about which topic? God.
Share
some stories.
One.
There's so many stories.
Okay, how about finding your voice? That is something you're really passionate about. Helping
great. Thank
people
you.
Find
Thanks
their
for
voice.
The topic. Now, see, this is a great example of why people think if I sat down with somebody and said, write a song, you'd never be able to do it. But if I'm like, hey, think of a melody that you know and then write words to it, right? It's the same thing with asking a question. This is why, like, songwriting and poetry writing and creativity, sometimes you just need a little lead in and then you can go ride your horse, right? Okay. So finding your voice. One thing I have learned is that in order to find your voice, you have to lose it.
Mm.
You cannot find something that you haven't lost, right?
Amen, sister.
The word find means you've lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people who feel like they have lost a part of themselves, or perhaps go through chapters in life where you feel like you have lost everything that you know, adults, if you live long enough, you have experienced that kind of loss, whether it's in someone dying, physically dying, or the death of what you've known, or the death of what you thought would be, the death of an idea, the death of a way of life, the death of a dream.
Yes.
And on the other side of, you know, dead dreams, there is a lot of life to live. And when you can see the idea of something that has passed as something that is ushering in a new sunrise, as opposed to a dead dream that will no longer come and I can never right? Because that is how you feel sometimes, right on the other side, the blank page. And to find your voice means that you have to have lost it. So if you feel like you've lost everything, congratulations, you are at the beginning of finding your voice. right?
Yes.
And so
thank you for the reminder.
Yeah, finding your voice as it is now. Finding the next chapter of your voice, finding the next chapter in the book of your life, finding the new words for the blank page. I have lost, you know, I look back at my life and with the things that I have walked through, and sometimes it feels like just an eternal letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, mm-hmm. letting go. And sometimes the ego side of me feels like, why have I had to have so many startovers? Why? Like, you know, you look at people and their life just seems so steady. Like, what is it about me that I've had to walk through these super excruciating things? And then I realize, you know, Ara, calm down. Actually, everybody's life is a series of letting go, yeah. letting go, letting go, letting go. This is just my version of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I tend to do things magnificently and then fall magnificently. So that's, you know, just part of my personality and part of my lesson, I think. But I perhaps making friends with stillness will help me even that out a bit, maybe getting older. But the letting go part is the part that nobody wants to do. We don't want to do the letting go mm-hmm. part, but we do want to, we want the new and we don't want the death. So yeah. I think part of finding your voice for me, finding my voice as it is now, has been just another few years of some acute letting go and leaning into the sunrise and the blank page. And I guess the story for me and for women, it seems like women generally are going through such a massive awakening right now
yes.
in this country, in this time.
So true.
So much of us are having to collectively say, no, thank you, no more.
Yeah.
No more to this. And we all maybe collectively thought we had to say yes to it at one time in our life. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, ladies, you realize, actually, yeah. we're done here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not angry anymore. I'm just done. Right. Yeah. And so when you're done, there's that blank page again. And I think women all around are seeing that. People call Nasty Woman a protest song. And Beth and I are like, this isn't a protest song. This is an awakening song. This is yeah. a tongue-in-cheek song about how ridiculous it is that mm-hmm. anything we do, it gets squashed. And we get to say now, thank you. No, thank you. Thank you for, you know, reminding me that I'm not someone that is worthy of being squashed. So I'm going to go over here and do it a different way, you know.
Yeah.
And I think finding your voice in your new way is just moving beyond the known. So if anybody's listening and they're in a chapter of utter unknown, then I would just say, you know, I love the word condolulations because you're so close. And try something new. Try something new. Try doing anything new that is creative, that's playful, that wakes up that part of you that's not so heavy. Life can be so heavy and creativity yeah. is so light and so easy and so playful, and it heals parts of you that you don't even know need to be healed, and it's such a subtle way that you don't see it coming, and one day you wake up and you hear the trees again and you hear the birds again, and it's because you've gotten still and learned to play again and found joy. So letting go is a part of that, and it's an inevitable part and an unavoidable part, and finding your voice. So I'm grateful for all the things I've been through, so my voice is what it is just as it is today, you know.
Oh, I'm grateful yeah. for you, Ara, yeah. and everything that you're bringing to the radio show today.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, and I love your heart.
Thank you,
great.
Liz.
So what you're on Vashon now, really yeah. quick before yeah. we wrap things yeah. up, a couple of things that you may offer on the island that yeah. people might want to know about.
Yeah, well, I think I am going to start teaching coaching music, being a voice coach, and
awesome.
helping especially adults find their voices. And not just musically, if people want to learn to sing, they can, but I always say I don't teach people how to sing. I teach people how to remember how to play, through their voice. And, also, I'm thinking about offering music lessons to kids again, because I really love it. I was just talking yeah. yesterday to somebody about finding a space to teach music together in the fall.
Awesome.
So as I'm finding my own way up here, I've been touring so much that's taken my energy, but I really mm-hmm. want to start getting my feet in the island, teaching voice lessons, helping women, especially women going through transition, to find a new way of being. I work also with people who have been performers for a long time who feel like their dry, dead raisin heart is happening creatively and they need to step outside of what they've been doing and try something new. And that's
right.
always fun to do together. So, yeah.
Awesome.
All that.
Thanks, Ara. You've
Thank
been
you,
a
Liz.
Gift to me.
Yes.
And I know you're going to be a gift to so many
too,
people
Liz.
In the future. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Liz. Thanks for doing this program. We need it.
Thank you. Thanks, Ari. I appreciate that. And thank you, everyone, for joining me this morning. I hope you have a great day, a great week, and I hope you get out there and raise the vibe. This is Raise the Vibe on KVSH, Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM. Goodbye, everyone.